So the topic for tonight is wise effort, the foundation of mindfulness and concentration. And I chose that title because wise effort, or traditionally called right effort, is the sixth step on the Eightfold Path. And it is the first of the three steps that are in the samadhi, the meditation part, the bhavana part of the Eightfold Path. And it's without right effort, all the attempts at concentration and mindfulness you want to try aren't going to be very successful. So that's why it comes first. and it's built on the foundation of the first five steps, and I'll talk more about that later. Interestingly, the word for effort in Pali is virya. Virya, from the root, same root, Indo-European root, is virile, strong, powerful. Just gives you a hint on where I'm going to go with this discussion in terms of how important energy. It's also translated as energy sometimes as opposed to effort. So there's a variety of different ways to view this, and I'll talk somewhat about all of those. It's also the fifth of the ten paramis, so it occurs like several important things in the Buddhist teachings in different lists in different places with the same intent. It's like, all right, now get to work, is essentially the message of this section of the Eightfold Path. You sort of, you've decided to practice, you've got your life in order, now you have to put some effort in. And I want to read something here from Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah was the teacher, one of the primary teachers of both Jack Kornfeld and Joseph Goldstein. They were both monastics in his Wat. So this is sort of going back to the original source teachings, in a sense. And I particularly like what he has to say here, so I thought I'd just start by reading someone else's words. Practice really has to depend on steadfastness and patient endurance. Some people start to practice meditation, and they have ideas and desires as to how they want it to be. They expect the mind to be calm right away. We've all been there, huh? But the old seeds and habits of turmoil are there, so the practitioners will have to experience their ripening. It's important to make efforts where this distress appears. We might feel we would be fine without such disciplines that cause us to feel bothered and oppressed. We would eat and sleep in comfort and at will. We could talk about whatever we like when we have the urge. We could go here and there as we wish and follow our impulses, like this would bring well-being. The teachings of the Buddha talk about resisting, grating against things. The way of transcendence grates against the worldly. Right view grates against wrong view. Purity grates against impurity. These things are always going to be incompatible. In the scriptures, there's a fable to illustrate this. Before the Buddha attained enlightenment, when he had accepted and eaten rice porridge from the milkmaid Sujata, he set the dish on the surface of a southerly flowing river and made the aspiration, if I'm going to become a supremely awakened Buddha, may this dish flow north. The dish flowed to the north. So the story goes. And it's sort of a great metaphor. You know, we have to, in this practice, swim against the current. We can't just sort of float along. We have to go against the current of our culture and of our habits. And that takes effort. It takes a lot of effort. You know, it's much easier just to sort of, oh, this seems cool, I'm going to do this now. And, you know, I was a hippie, I know all about how to do that. You know, but it doesn't work very well. And that's where this idea of effort, of energy, comes in. This seems contradictory or paradoxical in some senses, For instance, we're often told that we have Buddha nature. Right? We all have Buddha nature, and we're all perfect just as we are. Well, that's true in the world of absolute reality. That's absolutely true. Unfortunately, I think most of us here probably spend at least some time in the world of relative reality as opposed to the realm of absolute reality. And the world of relative reality doesn't seem so perfect. In fact, it seems often the opposite of that. It seems quite confusing, upsetting, difficult. Pick your word. The world seems full of suffering and anything but perfect. And we feel like we're full of suffering and anything but perfect. And that's where the effort is required. The effort that's required is in overcoming that idea that we're imperfect. That understanding, that thought, that mental process where we're constantly doubting ourselves, doubting our capability, doubting our ability to practice, doubting our ability. I had a friend who asked me recently, do you think you'll ever be enlightened? And I said, yeah. It was like, I don't doubt that. If we doubt that, if we have that doubt, the practice is way more difficult. Now, maybe it's not this lifetime. Probably not. Who knows? But I don't know. Who knows? You don't know. You have to keep putting in the effort. That's, of course, the issue we're talking about. And so you can't just say, oh, well, I'm perfect, so I don't have to do anything. It's real easy. I'm back to the hippies. That's what the hippies did. That's what we did as hippies. Like, oh, well, everything's cool, man. Everything's perfect. So I don't have to do anything. Just get high and I'll be okay. You know, didn't work too well. Another thing you hear sometimes is just all you need to do is let go. Just let go and everything will be fine and you'll become an enlightened being. All you have to do is let go. It sounds so easy, doesn't it? Oh, just let go. The trouble with letting go is it's actually really hard to let go. It takes a lot of effort to let go. Because we have these embedded habitual patterns of mind. And what we're talking about letting go is letting go of those habitual patterns. Those habitual patterns of mind that lead us to places where we're not anything even very close to perfect. In fact, we often act quite imperfectly and unwholesomely. But these are the patterns in our mind. And we have to let go of those mind habits. This takes a lot of work, because first of all, how can you let go of something if you're not even aware that it's going on? So a lot of the practice in the beginning, a lot of the effort in the beginning of practice is just tuning into these habitual mental patterns that we have. And they're insidious. They're everywhere. They're like most of our life, most of our waking life. That's what we're doing. We're caught in some story about ourselves. You know, where it might be the hero, we might be the villain, we might be the bum, we might be the great lover, we might be who knows what. But they're all just stories that we believe and then act upon. It's like our mind is full of movies, but every movie stars me. And the movies are so convincing, we believe that that's what life is and that's what's true. Our whole identity, our identity of self, arises out of these movies that we're constantly watching in our heads. And the practice has to do with applying the effort to, number one, see that that's what's going on, and then to let those go, to not believe those stories anymore. And we've been telling those stories to ourselves, some of them, since we had consciousness. You know, when we got out of diapers, we started telling ourselves some of those stories, pretty much. You know, more likely, we may be five. You know, a long time we've been telling ourselves these stories about ourselves. And that's what we have to let go. All those stories. All those ways we identify and create ourself. The separate me. So letting go, though it sounds kind of nice, is actually takes a lot of effort. Another word that comes out of the Pali word virya, is the root of virya is vira. And that means courageous or courage. That's another very good meaning that we have to be aware of when we're thinking about practicing. Because to practice, to really practice, to really go deeply into this practice, takes a lot of courage. Because you're going against the current. Because, you know, all your friends say, hey, let's go do X. And you say, no, it's Tuesday night. I'm going to go sit and meditate. And they sort of look at you kind of like, yeah, well, you know, he's gone a little weird. Or, you know, we all have those experiences, I'm sure, when we talk about our practice to people. Let alone, oh, I'm going away on a retreat for a month or whatever. Then, people really start to react to those ones. So this idea of courage, of being a Dharma hero, we have to be careful with that because it can very quickly become sort of, I'm great, I meditate. You know, you get sort of stuck on yourself and get puffed up, would be the word. Get to believe that you're different, you're special, you're better than everyone else. We don't want that part of the courage and hero story. But it is important that we have courage, that we approach this practice from a place of courageousness, but without pushing too hard. There's this, you know, balance we're always trying to achieve between effort and letting go, or trying, focusing, practicing, and not becoming rigid. The classic metaphor that the Buddha used all the time was when you're tuning a lute, you tune the strings too tight and this really horrible twangy sound comes out, and you tune them too loose and you don't get any sound at all. You just get mush. So you have to tune things just right, not too tight, but not too loose. Finding that balance is wise effort. And how to find that balance is a daily project. You know, how much effort you're going to put in today might be very different than tomorrow. Tomorrow, you get up, you get a phone call from a relative and things aren't going so well, and you get sort of thrown. Now your practice might be a different kind of effort, and it might be a very wholesome effort, but it's a different kind of effort that you're going to put in tomorrow than today when today was sunny and you went for a nice hike and it was a great day and I just hung out with my friends who were visiting and, you know, it was what a wonderful day. It wasn't hardly any effort at all to just stay there in the moment. Other times it's going to be really, really difficult. So it's not like something we can sort of figure out once. Wise effort is something we're figuring out all the time. Moment to moment, the amount of effort is adjusted to the situation. It's that balance between not too loose and not too tight. Otherwise, you know, if you, especially on the too tight side, the too loose side is kind of fun sometimes. Gotta watch that too. But the too tight side makes the practice really grim. It's like, oh, I gotta practice again. I'll sit here and, you know, I'll force myself and grimace my way through another 45-minute sit where my mind is full of, how come I can't do this? Grim practice. Don't want to go there. That's why all the statues of the Buddha, if you ever look at any statue of the Buddha you've ever seen, the Buddha has a tiny little smile on his face. He's enjoying himself sitting there or lying there. It's true. The iconography is very precise. The Buddha always has a smile. He's called the happy one for a reason. You know, so if you're not enjoying your practice, that's a really good clue that you're on the too tight side, that your lute is kind of twangy. You know, and it's time to sort of maybe ease off just a little bit. So, since you need to enjoy the effort, seems like a contradictory statement, huh? But still, you have to enjoy the effort. Classically, when we talk about right effort, there's a traditional teaching on the four aspects of right effort. And I want to read a little piece again here and then go into this. And this is now we're getting into the meat of the talk. This is all introductory up till now. So this is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness Meditation. And he's talking, interestingly enough, about training the heart. Remember in Pali and in many other Eastern languages, the word for heart and the word for mind is the same word, citta, heart-mind. So training the heart is training the mind. We don't often think of meditation as we're going to train the mind. But so Joseph's talking from the angle of training the heart, which is the same as training the mind anyway. But it's like you can sort of look at it from this side or from that side. So we can understand the training of the heart as being what the Buddha called the four great efforts. In our practice, we make the effort to diminish the unwholesome states of mind that have already arisen and to prevent those that have not yet arisen from arising. And conversely, we make the effort to strengthen those wholesome mental states that are already developed and to cultivate and develop the wholesome states that have not yet arisen. This, then, is the formula for transformation. First, we take a close look at the heart-mind and see what is what. Through the careful practice of looking, we develop a discriminating wisdom so that we understand for ourselves what mental states are unskillful, that is, leading to suffering, and what states are skillful, leading to happiness. And based on our experience, our own clear seeing, we begin to arouse these four great efforts. This is the training of the heart in which we are engaged. So I want to talk about these four great efforts. And they all, when you look at them, boy, I love this teaching because it makes so much sense to me. I mean, sometimes I think, what's that about? But this one, like, oh yeah, I can relate to this one. So the first is to do whatever you can to prevent unwholesome states of mind from arising. In practice, you know, you see a familiar pattern of thought arising. And you go, oh, I know where this is going. I've been here before. That is the moment when you can make a choice. When you can go, nah, I don't have to go there. I don't have to follow this chain of thought to the conclusion I know it's going to come to. The story it's going to tell me that's going to lead me into unwholesome mind states. I don't have to go there. It's as simple as that. Being careful, of course, that this doesn't turn into avoidance. Something unpleasant arises. Oh, I don't have to go there. It could be, I don't want to go there because it's really unpleasant and maybe I need to actually look at this stuff. So there's that, once again, that balance between, you know, too tight and too loose. You know? On the other hand, you know, this old story comes up and you've been through this story 40 times in the last 3 days, which on a, you know, longer sits happens sometimes. It's that same thing. Oh God, that again. It's very wise sometimes just to go, eh, not going there. When I first heard this idea, I was kind of shocked, to be honest with you. Because up until then, I'd always believed that mindfulness meditation was strictly, you sit, whatever arises, that's what you pay attention to. And now we're saying, yeah, but there's a point when that's unskillful, when it's not useful any longer, especially if you're not looking at the underneath of the story, but just watching that movie yet again for the 40th time. It's unskillful to do that. It's not going to lead anywhere. It's just going to make you feel like your head is spinning yet again, which is pretty much what it is doing, spinning. This first aspect essentially is the fruition of the first five steps on the Eightfold Path. We have right understanding. We understand that things are impermanent. You know, that things as they are unsatisfactory because they don't lead to true happiness. We know that. If you didn't know that, you probably wouldn't be here. So we have that understanding. We've set the intention. We have right intention to practice. And then we've been consciously choosing to practice right speech or wholesome speech, wholesome action, wholesome employment, wholesome life. All of those are the things that when we look at them, we understand what's wholesome and what's not, and what's not. What's going to be useful and what's not. What's skillful and what's not. Through that lens, through that understanding of all of those first five steps, we have a very clear understanding of what leads to wholesome mind states and what doesn't. And by practicing those first five steps, we naturally start to practice this first stage of right effort, of knowing what leads to unwholesome mind states, of really having a clear understanding of that and choosing not to go there. You know, in our daily life, we all have moments. At least I do, maybe you don't, where I'm about to do something and I'll go, oh, I know what's going to happen if I do that. You know, I know what unwholesome mind state that's going to lead to. But it's so seductive. And then I get caught again, and then somewhere along the line I realize, God, here I am stuck in this unwholesome, grumpy, sad, whatever mind state that I knew was coming 15 minutes ago or 5 days ago or whatever, and I just got sucked into that story. Well, this time it'll be different. We all tell ourselves that. This time I'll be okay. I won't get caught in that whirlpool. And we all do. So in our daily life, what this first aspect of wise effort means is looking at every aspect of our life. Everything we do. Everybody we hang out with. Everything we do in general. And go, where does that go to? Where does that lead me? Does that lead me to a wholesome place or an unwholesome place? To a skillful place or an unskillful place? So in our lives, this takes in everything. There's nothing, you can't sort of say, well, I really have really skillful effort while I'm sitting, but the rest of the time, I'm going to just do what I want. Because if that happens, then you're going to spend most of your time caught in regret and remorse and guilt and all those feelings that arise when you've done something unskillful. Not going to be a real fun time practicing. And the mind's going to be in a lot of turmoil, it's not going to be a lot of calmness. So, right effort starts at the very beginning of everything, in that sense. We have to look at everything. Then, the second of these is to do whatever we can to get rid of wholesome mind states that have already arisen. So there we are. We weren't particularly mindful, and now here we are caught in some unwholesome mind state. And then we sort of wake up and we go, holy moly, look where my mind is now. In this place yet again, typically, because we usually recognize the places when we get caught in them. They're familiar. What do we do now? Well, two things. Well, actually there's five things, but we're going to talk about that later. But initially, there's two things. One is, if this is new territory, because sometimes you get to a place and it's not like there's not a big story, it's just like you're in turmoil. It's sometimes very skillful just to stop and pay attention, not to the story that's going on, but the underlying emotions. In particular, the body sensations associated with those underlying emotions. Because often the body will give you very clear clues about what's going on. You know, there'll be a discomfort of some sort, a tightness, a jitteriness, a collection of heat. Lots of different physical symptoms will arise that are associated with very strong, unwholesome states of mind. So it's often very skillful when you wake up to the fact that, oh, this is going on, to just drop into the body, pay attention to what's going on there, because that'll give you some pretty clear hints. So this can be a skillful thing to do, to actually hang out with this unpleasant mind state, this unwholesome mind state, and see what it's really like. Because now, it's no longer an unwholesome mind state. Now it's just an object of meditation. You've flipped it into just, this is what's going on, this is what's actually rising in the moment, now I'm going to pay attention to it. Now this is just skillful practice. You're now paying attention to what's actually arisen and is rising and flowing right now. It's not a problem anymore. It's just this is what you're practicing with. It might be unpleasant. In fact, it might be really unpleasant. But it's pure practice at this point. Just flip it in that way. And it becomes just another thing to practice. It's just, if the practice really is paying attention to what's actually arising, if something really unpleasant, unwholesome has arisen, and you're aware that that's what's going on in your mind, perfect practice. As long as you stay aware. So that story, that same story can be running, but you can be aware of the entire story. And look at it. And in some sense, just sort of step back and giggle a little bit sometimes. Have a little light sense of humor about it too. Not sort of just, oh God, I'm so bad, I've got this story running again. You know, and you get caught in that beat yourself up story. Just, oh, this one again. You know, I have, when I do long practice sessions, and I often have repeating stories, I give them names. You know, that guy at IBM who didn't treat me right story. You know, or, which is actually one of my recurring themes, and one of my, it's old story about being treated poorly by this guy. It's just, I don't know why that particular one, but it's like, happened 30 years ago, I go on a long set, at least once, maybe twice during the set, this whole story will play in my mind. Who knows? You know, it's just one of those stories, right? So we have to look at these things, accept that this is what's going on, and be okay with it. But at a certain point, as I mentioned earlier, this is no longer fruitful. Joseph Goldstein, I was sitting with him once, and he said, if you've had the same thought more than 5 times, it's probably not very useful anymore. So you've looked at it. You've looked at it from different angles. You've lived with it. You've hung out with it. You've experienced all the unpleasantness of it. Maybe it's time to see if we can instead shift things, as I mentioned earlier. And there's this wonderful sutta. I won't try and pronounce the Pali name. It's got like 9 syllables in it. So. But it's called, the translation is called The Removal of Distracting Thoughts. Once again, when I first read this sutta, it was like, wow, this was like a revelation. Like, I can actually not just sit there and suffer. I can actually consciously choose to shift things. Skillful practice sometimes means taking action. Actually shifting the process that's going on in your mind. And there are 5 levels to this. 5 degrees of this practice in the suttas. And the first of these is just to give attention to something wholesome instead. There you are, caught in an unwholesome mind state. Often it's about somebody, that jerk at IBM, or whatever, you know. Just shift that to a wholesome mind state. Classically, what's taught is do metta for that person. Instead of thinking about that jerk from IBM, you know, may he be safe, may he be happy, and just practice metta for that person who you are having all these unpleasant, unwholesome emotional stories about. Shift the emotional state. And just doing that, consciously choosing to make that shift to a wholesome thought about that person or a set of wholesome thoughts about that person. And if you're not doing formal metta, it's even like, you know, if there's some person that really bugs you and that's what the story's about, try and think about something good about that person. You know, they really love their dog. And think of them with their dog playing and going for a walk with their dog. Shift the story to something wholesome. And just that all by itself is often enough to just shift in that unwholesome story, unwholesome mindset just goes away. Simple. But, as the Buddha says, doesn't always work. So, the second one, this is one that we have to be careful with, but he says, think about the danger of the unwholesome thoughts. Think about where those unwholesome thoughts are going. You've jumped on the train, think where the train's going. You know where it's going. Think about that. Remind yourself of the results when you've been in this unwholesome mind state the last 500 times and got on the train. He has a little similes for what this might mean in the real world. He says, and this, I love this one, that's why I want to read it. He says, just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog were hung around his or her neck. So it's like, ooh, that's where this is going to go. You know, it's like, it's strong language. And the Buddha did this sometimes because it meant something to people. Snakes and dogs in East Asia are very low, low, low creatures. To have one hung around your neck would be the ultimate in uki. Yes, I mean, for us it would be too, but even theirs even worse because they're considered very, very low creatures. But it's like, think about it. Oh, look, this is where that's going to go. Actually, think about the results of having this unwholesome mind state. And that might just make it, it's just like, whew, caught that one. And it just goes away. The next one, now we're getting into more difficult and somewhat more contentious territory. The third one is try to forget the thoughts. Do some deeper concentration practice. You know, if you've ever done any concentration practice, my favorite one is just watching the breath and counting backwards from 10. It's pretty hard to think about anything else when you're doing that. You know, so it's in, out, 10. In, out, 9. If you're really successfully keeping that count and staying with the breath, the mind just empties of anything else, because if anything else is there, you're going to lose the concentration. So just shift to not paying attention. I've paid attention to you for 3 days. I'm not going to pay attention to you anymore. Not going to go there. And concentration practice, shifting from this sort of wide open Vipassana state to something very precise and focused, is often skillful. Metta is another form of concentration practice. And once again, metta might be effective here. I think for me, it takes something more, even sort of forceful and precise than metta to shift when I get this deep in. So the simile here is just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that had come within range of sight would either shut his eyes or look away. That might be the most skillful thing to do is not, no, I'm not going to give that any attention. Might be the skillful thing to do. Understanding, of course, as I've said before in this talk, that you're not just doing that out of pure avoidance. I don't want to go there because it's okay. I don't want to think about that. We've already thought about it. We've already paid attention to it. We've already looked at it deeply. We've already felt the emotions. Enough already. Now let's let this one go. Then the fourth one of these is, if none of these have worked, then he talks about stilling the thought formations. And the analogy he uses is, I'll just read this. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And then he would think, what if I sit? What if I lie down? So he's consciously slowing things down. Often when we're caught in these strong emotional, unwholesome mind states, the mind feels like it's going 90 miles an hour. It's just zinging. And just consciously seeing whatever you can do just to slow it down might be successful. It might actually let it go. Then we come to number 5. This one is labeled, don't try this at home. Or, do this only with the instructions of a competent teacher. But it's interesting that the Buddha goes this far, I think. So if nothing has worked, you've done all these other things and you're still there, that story's still there, all that stuff and all the energy and emotion is still there. Then, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. That's strong language. That's like, okay, I'm had really enough. And I'm just going to stop this right now. This is dangerous. This is like, you know, speed skating downhill. You know, be very careful. Don't just think, oh, I can always just do this. But this is right out of the Sutta. I'm not making this up. This is right out of the Sutta, what the Buddha said. That might be what is required sometimes, to be really, really forceful. I read this, the first time I read this, I was like, what? But then I looked, yeah, this is right now. Look, yeah, the same book, it's still there. The interesting thing about this one, and now I'll add a little lightness about this, is Joseph Goldstein, once again, has a great view on this idea that is somewhat lighter. This is from a talk where he was giving on these 5 states, 5 levels. In the 5th method, when all else fails, the Buddha suggests forcibly suppressing the unwholesome thought. One way of doing this is imagining oneself shooting down these thoughts as soon as they arise, like shooting down targets at an amusement park shooting gallery game. When he gives his talk, he sort of goes like this. I found this method particularly helpful with recurrent unwholesome thoughts that have already been seen so many times that it's not a question of denial or suppression of feeling. Here, it's an attitude that takes no quarter but involves a sense of humor. I call this method cowboy dharma. The same idea as the Buddha in slightly lighter language. But, it's like, that's what sometimes it's like, that's it. I can't. You know, there's that movie called Network where everybody goes to the window and yells out, I can't, I'm not going to take it anymore, or something like that. It's quite a great scene in this movie where this guy on TV, he's an announcer, he says, if you can't stand what's going on with the government, I want everybody to go to the window and open up and scream. And then it's like downtown New York and everybody's opening the windows and there's all these people screaming, I can't stand it. And anyhow, that's what it's basically like. It's like, I've got to the end of my tether. I have to deal with this. I think the interesting thing about this particular sutta is it points out that this practice is anything but passive. It was often presented, this practice, as just sitting there and being with whatever's arising. And what the Buddha is very clearly pointing out is,
Yeah, but sometimes that's not very useful. And you have to, and the wise effort, the wisdom part of that word, that phrase, is in determining when this is now required. Whether it's just that light replacing that unwholesome thought with a wholesome thought, or, you know, the more drastic layers, you know, closing your eyes and looking away. Whether that's what's required. That's where the wisdom aspect comes. And this practice, and it's something you learn. This practice is something you learn. It's called skillful means. We have to learn when this is what's required as opposed to just being there and being aware of what's arising in the moment. And this is the difficult part of the practice. That's where the tricky part is. This skillful means stuff. But it is necessary. Okay. Enough about that. Now let's talk about the good stuff. The third aspect of right effort is sort of a partner to the first. And that is to do whatever you can to create the causes and conditions so that wholesome mind states arise. You're all doing that right now. You all came here. You could have been home listening to the ball game or watching reruns of Game of Thrones or something. I don't know. But you're here. You're doing things that create causes and conditions so that wholesome mind states arise. It really is the opposite of the first. We already, like at the first five steps in the Eightfold Path, tell us what it is that we need to do so that the causes and conditions will arise, that wholesome mind states will arise. That, you know, the joy and compassion and loving kindness, they'll arise as opposed to their opposites. That's what the first five steps on the Eightfold Path are talking about. Here's how to create wholesome mind states. But we have to remind ourselves of this. Because it's a choice we have to make over and over and over. Every time we're sort of sitting there going, oh, what am I going to do now? We all have that experience more than once a day, maybe. Now you can choose. Am I going to do things that create a wholesome mind state or an unwholesome mind state? You're making that choice over and over and over again. And the more you make the choice that creates causes and conditions so that wholesome mind states arise, the more likely they will. No guarantee they'll arise right at that moment. Oh, I think I'll have some loving kindness now. You know, that doesn't work. But if you just start doing loving kindness practice as you're walking down to go get the groceries, you're walking along and blessing, you know, everybody you see, say, may you be safe, may you be happy. Say that to the dog walking next to the guy who's walking his dog. All beings. That might give a chance of actually creating a wholesome mind state as you're walking to get the groceries. Or driving on the freeway to Denver. It can still be a wholesome mind state. It's hard to believe, but actually it's getting better. So, once again, it's all about making choices. And you can make the choice to create the conditions where wholesome mind states arise. And then, by golly, they'll start to arise. It's as simple as that. The last of these four seems really obvious in a sense. That is, when wholesome mind states arise, do whatever you can to preserve them. So you're sitting there, you notice, gee, I'm feeling it's good. This is right. It feels right. You have that. It's a physical sensation. I found for me, there's always a physical sensation of life. Like, it's calm. It's still. I feel sort of centered and focused. I'm sort of aware of what's going on. It's not like I'm not floating on air or anything like that. I'm just like I'm tuned in. Then do what you can to keep that, to actually preserve that wholesome mind state. And this is actually kind of tricky. This actually takes effort. Because our natural tendency is to look for what's wrong. Our natural tendency is to look at what's wrong with everybody else and with us. That's where our mind usually goes. That's the natural tendency of mind. It's what our culture teaches us to do. and what our physiology at a certain level teaches us to do. And so when you notice them, then you say, oh, I think I'll just sit here for a while longer. It's nice and still here. I'm watching the birds at my bird feeder or whatever. I'll just sit here and watch the birds a little longer. Look at the flowers in my garden or whatever it is, you know, whatever you're doing. And just do what you can to actually preserve that mind state. Often what happens, if you're not careful, is you see this wholesome mind state arise, and then you go, oh, I gotta keep it. Well, as soon as you think that, it's gone, buddy. Because now you've grasped it. Now you've fallen into desire, an unwholesome mind state, just like that. So it's tricky. You can't want to keep it, you just do what you can to have it keep it. So once again, there's that skillful means. And you have to watch for the flip side of these states when they arise. Like, I can't allow myself to be this calm. I should be really busy. I should be doing something useful. No, you're doing something really useful just sitting there being calm, actually. But we don't allow ourselves that. Or, even more insidious, I don't deserve to be this happy. There goes your wholesome mind state. Just that thought, it's gone. So watch for those, because they're traps in our culture. I don't have time to be this relaxed. I don't have time to feel this good. I'm too busy to feel this good. Or I don't even deserve it. You have to see those thoughts arise and go, no, those are just unwholesome mind states. I can let them go and just be with the wholesome mind state. I can enjoy this. This is where the enjoyment comes into practice. And we want to, if we don't acknowledge these states and do what we can to preserve them, practice is always grim, because all we're doing is noticing the bad stuff. Oh, there I am, caught in this unwholesome mindset again, and then I do this. And this really, you get yourself bummed out really quickly. But if you notice this good stuff when it arises, and acknowledge it and accept it as real, and you deserve it, then it becomes, oh, this practice has the flip side. This is the flip side of grim. This is joyful. This is, I'm happy, and I'm practicing. And it might be not like bubbling, giggling, laughing, happy, but it's happy. This feels right. Those are those moments we really want to cherish. Oops. So I'm basically, in summing up wise effort, it's a matter of learning how to practice. In a sense, that's really what I'm talking about. There's the practice as it's, you know, taught, and then there's the actual practice as you learn to actually do it, to actually experience an unwholesome mind state arising, see it for what it is, and decide how to work with it. That's why they call it practice. You know, oh, they also call it practice because, don't worry, you'll mess it up a lot. Before, you'll try something and it won't work and it'll make it worse and you'll feel really crummy and you'll beat yourself up for doing it worse. And then you realize that you're in another unwholesome mind state, and, you know, and it just goes on and on. But you'll, over time, learn to work with what's arising in skillful ways. And know when to stay with it, when to start to shift it a little bit. When to, this is good, I think I'll stay here. I think I'll just sit here and be still and calm. And my mind feels crystal clear, and I can just see things arising and there for a while and they're gone. I can see impermanence. It's just, you have those moments that are very clear and perfect, where there is nothing to let go of, where there is nothing imperfect. It's all just what is. Really cherish those moments, because they will come. That's where the practice leads. And is my habit. This is a great poem by Mary Oliver from her book. book called Why I Wake Early. It's called The Song of the Builders. And this sort of, I think, sums up everything I've said quite clearly. On a summer morning, I sat down on the hillside to think about God, a worthy pastime. Near me, I saw a single cricket. It was moving the grains of the hillside this way and that way. How great was its energy! How humble its effort! Let us hope it will always be like this, each of us going on in our inexplicable ways, building the universe. Perfect description of right effort from my point of view. So we have a few minutes for questions and comments. I always, as usual, talk too long. Anybody has anything to share, any questions to ask, any comments to make? Sarah was going to hand you a mic. I was supposed to give her the high sign, but I forgot. And if no one wants to say anything, we can just sit for a couple of minutes and then we can go. That's fine too. Just wait until the mic gets here.
Just hold it very close.
All right. It's just kind of a funny story. When I first learned kayaking, right, I go on the Colorado River and there was this, I was with a class, and so I go in my kayak, the river goes clearly downhill, right? And so I go in my kayak and I start paddling. And then the guide kind of looks at me and says, "Why are you paddling?" I kind of stop. I mean, the river is already taking you. Why don't you just relax? And then when we get to the white water, then you work. I just thought that was a real nice example of this. You know, you got to know when to put effort into something.
Perfect. Perfect. Know? In the real world, perfect. That's it's like coasting up downhill and pedaling uphill when you're riding your bike. Other thoughts, comments, questions?
What you're saying about effort, it just made me think of another anecdote, like a real life story. And this is someone who, like yourself, is involved in like construction projects and stuff. And there was a garage, an old garage, with a supporting beam that had, you know, was like this.
Warped
down. And he had to, you know, move it up. But like, there's no way that could happen quickly, because other things would crumble and stuff. So he said what he did was he put a jack, and every day he'd go by and he'd just go click, click for 3 weeks. And he said everything else adjusted. And I thought that was a wonderful analogy for the right amount of effort at the right time and consistently. And then it's going in a vector where everything changes, you know.
Wonderful. Thank you. We have time for maybe one more thought, comment, question.
The unhappy mind is always looking for something to make it better. But the happy mind, the Buddha says, is easily concentrated. Because by being happy, it's not in search so much for something else. So in terms of cultivating wholesome mind states, one of the instructions is, breathing in, I calm the mind. Breathing out, I calm the mind. Breathing in, I gladden the mind. Breathing out, I gladden the mind. Breathing in, I concentrate the mind. Breathing out, I concentrate the mind. Breathing in, I liberate the mind. Breathing out, I liberate the mind. I like that sequence, and there are other sequences like this, but that sequence of developing wholesome mind states begins with calm, and then gladness, and then concentration, and leading to liberation. So there are lots of good wholesome states, and a lot of them lead to other good, wholesome states.
Yes. Thank you, Don. Okay, it's 9 o'clock. It's late. Why don't we just dedicate the merit of our practice and go home with smiles on our faces. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you for your kind attention.